for the phrase, the term icebreakers, I bet you think of those fun little get-to-know-you questions that maybe you ask in a small group setting with people you don't really know yet to kind of begin the conversations. Or maybe you've asked this on a first date before. You had to walk in with a great icebreaker because the person on the other side of the table didn't know you and you didn't know them, and it was just really awkward. You thought, I got to break the ice with a great question. Or I've even seen this used in the marketplace, you know, to get to know people. Maybe you're in a meeting with people who you just don't know. And so you have an icebreaker question that kind of helps break the ice to get to know people. And there are really good icebreaker questions. Things like, what is your favorite hobby? That's a great icebreaker question for a lot of you. What do you do for a living is a great icebreaker question. Unless you're a pastor, it's a terrible icebreaker question because people realize what you do and then they review the past 30 minutes of their life and it's just awkward and then they won't talk to you anymore. So it's awesome. So that's my life. And there are some really bad icebreaker questions. I've used a few of these, like, how much do you weigh? Really bad icebreaker question, okay? I asked that one day as a joke and nobody would talk to me for an hour at small group, so don't ask that one. But there are good ones, but at the core of the icebreaker question is a principle, and it's a really a principle of connection. And I think we intuitively already know that. That's why we ask those kind of icebreaker questions. So what we're going to do for the next 3 weeks is we're going to look at one single verse that Paul wrote in the book of Colossians that really sits, I think, at the heart and the center of this principle of connection. And this verse is really a special verse to me and my family because when we lived in Peachtree City in our previous house, we actually had this verse painted on the wall of our keeping room. Now, what is a keeping room, you might ask? I have no idea what a keeping room is, okay? It's where we kept the TV and we kept the sofa and it kept me there all the time. I don't know what a keeping room is. But in our keeping room, above our television, we had this verse painted on the wall. Now, when Chantel, my wife, came to me and said, hey, Gavin, I think we should paint a Bible verse on the wall of our keeping room. And I said, what is a keeping room? And she said, stop asking that dumb question. And she said, I think we should paint a verse. And I took it upon myself to make several suggestions of what I thought we should paint on the wall of the keeping room. And as I kind of opened up the Bible, you know, being a biblical scholar like all of you, I found some great verses that I thought we should paint on the walls. And so here was my first suggestion. You're going to immediately know why this was a great opportunity. This is in Ephesians. I thought we should just paint this on the wall of our house, right? Who doesn't want that on the wall of their house, right? Everybody wants that. Wives, submit yourself to your own husbands as you do to the Lord. I mean, who doesn't want that, right? For the husband is the head of the wife. And Chantel said, we're not painting that on our wall. And I said, why not? It's biblical, you know, it's in the Bible. And she said, well, we should paint the rest of it where it says, you're supposed to love me like Christ loved the church. And I said, I don't remember that part, but I remember this. And she said, stop taking the Bible out of context. And I said, that's what you're supposed to do. It's what everybody does, you know? And so she said, that was a bad idea. She said, stop making suggestions. They're all terrible, which is funny because that's the same conversation we had when we were naming our children, right? So I get it. And then I thought, I got a better idea. Why don't we paint verses all over the entire house? In all the rooms of the house, we should paint Bible verses. So in our kids' rooms, I suggested we paint this from Psalms. Be still. And the rest of the verse says, and know that I am God. But I thought, forget that. If you can just be still, that would be so helpful. And while I'm in the keeping room watching TV, you know, just be still, right? And then I thought, we should have a Bible verse in our bathroom, right? Who doesn't want a Bible verse in their bathroom? So I found this in Deuteronomy, perfect bathroom Bible verse. As part of your equipment, have something to dig with. And when you relieve yourself, dig a hole and cover up your excrement. It's perfect. See, you didn't even know that was in the Bible, did you? That's in the Bible. And we tell you all the time, you should read your Bible, right? You're like, no. Now all the guys are like, I'm totally reading Deuteronomy when I get home. That's awesome, right? That's in Deuteronomy. And again, she said, stop being a middle schooler. This is terrible. And I thought, this is awesome. Then I decided we should have a Bible verse painted in our master bedroom because who doesn't want that, right? But I can't show you because she said I wasn't allowed to. But if you open up the Bible and go to Song of Songs, you can pick any one of those bad boys out. It is perfect, right? Now, all the guys, again, are like, Deuteronomy, Song of Songs. I'm reading those two tonight. Okay, so Here's what happened. After all of these suggestions, and she told me to stop, I wasn't allowed to talk for like 24 hours, okay? After all of these bad suggestions, she went away, pulled her Bible out, and said, I'm going to find a verse that we should paint on the wall of the keeping room. And she came back to me a couple days later, and she said, Gavin, I found it. I found the perfect verse to paint on the wall of the keeping room. And I said, now, what is a keeping room again? She said, shut up, not funny. She goes, I found the perfect verse. And when she showed me the verse, you know what? I looked at it and said, that is the perfect verse to have painted on the wall of our keeping room. It was the perfect verse, I thought, for our house. And that's the verse that we're actually going to talk about today and over the next 2 weeks as well. But before I tell you what that verse was, let me back up a little bit and give you the context for that verse, because again, Chantel's in the room and she knows context is really important, apparently, in the Ephesians scripture. So the context of this verse is Paul is writing a letter to the Christians in the city of Colossae. There probably were multiple churches there. There were a lot of Christians there. Paul was a missionary and a church planter. He traveled all over the known world planting these brand new churches, these ecclesias, as we call them. And in these new churches, there were all sorts of problems, as you can imagine, because this was a brand new faith. These were brand new churches. There was all sorts of persecution going on. And so Paul would write letters to these guys to encourage them, to let him know that he's been praying for them, and just to kind of help them along. And so as he is writing this letter to these Christians, he writes one verse that is just so important, I think, for us as Christians. And a lot of times when we try to apply the Bible for us today, it's not always easy. But in this verse, it should be really easy, because he was writing it directly to Christians. And so if you're a Christian in the room, I would say that this verse directly applies to us. So if you have your Bible, we're going to be in the book of Colossians. Colossians is a really short book. It's only 4 chapters long. And we're going to be in chapter 4 towards the end. Now, we're going to back up to verse 3 before we get to the verse that we painted on the wall. Here's what it says, verse 3, and pray for us, he's talking to the Christians in the city of Colossae, pray for us too, that God may open a door for our message, so that we may proclaim the mystery of Christ. He's asking them to pray for him, because he wants to deliver the message of hope and salvation and freedom that really can only be found in Jesus. And so here's what he says next, for which I am in chains, pray that I may proclaim it clearly as I should. That's verse 4. Now, at the end of verse 4, he's asked them to pray for him, and he turns the letter back on these Christians in verse 5. And here's what he tells them, and I think what Paul would tell us today as well. Be wise in the way you act towards outsiders. Make the most of every opportunity. Be wise in the way you act towards outsiders. Now, when I first read this, that word outsiders kind of bothered me a little bit, because if you're here in the room today and you're not a Christian, this is who Paul is talking about. He would say that you're an outsider. And that word kind of feels a little awkward to me, but I imagine if you are here today and you're not a Christian, you might feel a little bit like an outsider. In fact, before you came today, you may have told your friends, I think I'm going to feel like an outsider walking into your church. In fact, I invite people to our church all the time because I love our church. I love what you have created here. And when I invite people, a lot of times they tell me, well, I'm a little bit of an outsider when it comes to God and Christianity and the faith and all that. I don't even really believe in all that stuff. And I would feel like an outsider. In fact, if I were to walk in your church, I'm afraid the walls may spontaneously combust and lightning would strike it. So I don't think I can go to your church and I tell them, hey, you should see the people who are at our church, right? It hasn't burned down yet, so I think you're good, you know? So they're outsiders. And so if you feel like that, well, you're in good company. There's a lot of you in our community, and there may be a lot of you in the room, and we're glad that you're here. But Paul isn't really writing this to you. He's writing it to those of us who maybe we would say are insiders. And he says that we should be wise in the way we act around you and with you and to you. And we should make the most of every opportunity. Now, how should we do that? And verse 6 tells us how. And verse 6 is the verse that we had painted on the keeping room of our house in Peachtree City. And here's what verse 6 says. Let your conversation be always full of grace, seasoned with salt. Isn't that a beautiful verse? When Chantel showed me this verse, I thought, man, that is the perfect verse to have on the wall of our house, because I thought the keeping room is right beside the kitchen, and Paul talks about salt, so why would you not want to have that there? I love salt. Paul talks about salt. It's near the kitchen, and I thought even more, it talks about grace, And so every single day that I came home late from playing golf or late from work or I didn't take the trash to the street for the whole month of February, she's walking around in her house going, full of grace, full of grace, full of grace, full of grace. And I thought, I'll never get in trouble again, you know, because full of grace, seasoned with salt. This is the perfect verse to have on the wall of our house. Win, win, win. But there is a word in this verse that as I read it year after year after year, that I think I just always completely skipped by. There's just this one word that I always kind of overlooked. I never really paid attention to it. There's just one word that as I was, you know, begging for grace and seasoning my okra with salt, that I just never really noticed until a few years ago. And it's really the word conversation. Let your conversation be always full of grace, seasoned with salt. You know, the Bible is pretty strategic, and the words that these guys chose to write always meant something. And so I started thinking, why did Paul write conversation? Like, why didn't he just say, let our talking, you know, or let what we say? He said, let our conversation. See, conversation is different than talking, isn't it? Conversation is like a journey of talking. Conversation is a process. Conversations take a lot of time. In fact, a lot of times, conversations happen over a span of time. Conversations always have a beginning, but a lot of them really don't have a true ending. Conversations, like a journey, have a lot of twists and turns. There are ups and downs. There are agreements, and there are disagreements. But in the end, I think here's what we all kind of intuitively know about conversation, is that conversation is the key to connection. Conversation is the key to connection. If you're going to connect with anyone relationally, you know that conversation is probably where it's really going to start. And Paul knew that as well. Now, what's great about this truth, and I think this is just a principle of connection. What's great about this is that in every relational aspect of our life, we know this to be true. If you are married and you want to have a healthy marriage, you are going to have a lot of conversations. And I mean a lot of conversations. And some of those conversations may be very loud conversations. Some people call that yelling. I call that impassioned conversing, okay? But some of them are going to be really loud, and you're not always going to agree, are you? But you're going to keep talking. In fact, when we watch marriages that are in trouble, inevitably part of the problem is that one of the people decided to lean away from conversation. One of the spouses decided, that's it, I'm not going to talk with him anymore. I'm not going to talk with her about this anymore. And that began a slow, steady death of the relationship. Because conversation is the key to connection. In fact, some of you would still be in your first marriages, wouldn't you? If you would have chosen to have more conversations. If you would have chosen not to talk at your spouse, but instead chose to talk with your spouse, things would be different. When you think about our children, you know, in parenting, we want to have a relationship with our kids. But a relationship doesn't come through discipline. We should discipline our kids. Our kids need to understand that negative consequences come from bad choices. Some of you probably need to discipline your kids a lot more. In fact, I've seen some of your kids. No, I'm just kidding. I haven't. But some of your friends have seen your kids, and they would say, you should discipline your kids much more. But here's what we know. Discipline doesn't build a relationship. Discipline doesn't foster their hearts. Discipline teaches them a lesson. But if we want to grab the heart of our children, it's going to come through conversations. It's not going to come through moments of talking. It's going to be ongoing journeys of conversations. I'll tell you, when I was a kid, I did this a lot with my mom and dad, but there were moments where this didn't always happen. I remember the most awkward one of those was when I had the talk when I was about 12. It was the most miserable 30 minutes of my life. It was like super awkward. I mean, I just thought the whole time, please let this in. Please let this in. Please let this in. La, 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 right? But when my kids started getting older, I talked to my wife about this, and I said, you know what? We're not going to have a talk. We're going to have a conversation, and we're going to begin a conversation, and the conversation probably isn't going to end for a long time. And so when I sat down with my oldest, I said, hey, I want to talk about something, but we're just going to start talking today, and you're probably going to have a lot of questions, and we're going to answer some of those questions, and we're just going to talk about it for years and years and years because it's really important to have a conversation around that idea. And you know what? I don't really so much care about her behavior as much as I care about her heart. Because if I can get her heart, her behavior will follow suit. And I know the only way to do that is to lean into conversation. You know, when you think about all your friendships, every deep friendship you have is built on the shoulders of a conversation. And the deeper the friendship, the more conversations you have. It's a principle. Conversation is the key to connection. So, With that truth in mind that we already knew, that's why none of you wrote it down, right? With that truth in mind, why is it that as Christians, we are so bad at bringing this principle into our interactions with people who are not Christians? Why is it that as Christians, we don't handle our interactions and our encounters with people who don't believe what we believe in light of conversation? Why is it that we struggle so much to connect with people who aren't like us spiritually? See, as Christians, here's what I have found, and this is what I grew up watching and experiencing, probably like you. As Christians, we just don't have a lot of conversations. We have a lot of conversion attempts. Those are really fun, right? We have a lot of confrontations. We have a lot of agendas. We have a lot of projects. We have a lot of things, but we don't have a lot of conversations. We just don't have a lot of conversations. In fact, we do more to probably push people away than draw people in. It's almost as if we read Paul's verse to say, let your confrontations, not let your conversations. See, just like you, I've been on the wrong side of some really well-meaning Christians before. It happens even now, you know, and I bump into people now, and I'm like, I'm a pastor, good grief, I'm on your team. And they go, I don't think you are, you know, and I go, no, I am, I'm a pastor. And it's just awkward because it's kind of confrontational, you know. It's like a conversion attempt, and it just doesn't feel good. It doesn't draw me in. When I think about this, man, my most vivid experience when it comes to this confrontation issue really happened when I was 15. And when I was 15, I grew up in the church. We went to a really great church when I was 15. And when I was 15, I had started dating Chantel, who I eventually married 6 years later. But we had just started dating, and it was fresh, and it was new. And like, I was head over heels for this girl. I mean, she was awesome. She was beautiful. She probably didn't feel that way about me, but I was going to convince her over time, you know. And I was in love with her. And so we would go to the youth group on Wednesday night at the church that we were attending, that I was attending. She wasn't going there. I would bring her with me. And we would go to this youth group thing, and I would go anywhere I could to spend time with her. And so I would drag her along with me, and we'd spend time together. And at the end of this youth group, we would always kind of find ourselves in the back parking lot with all of our friends, and we'd stand in a circle and just loiter around, which I guess is probably not healthy, but we would do that. And we would all just sit back there and talk. And so one day as we were back there talking, and it was just on the back side of the back door, there was a bunch of cars, a bunch of people out there. The associate pastor of this church who baptized me a few years earlier walks by us, and he kind of looks and he sees us all standing in a circle talking. And he looks at me and he says, son, can you come up here for a minute? And you know, I was 15. I'm like, yes, sir. I mean, what do you say to that? It's kind of weird, you know? And so I followed this associate pastor over, and we went about 15 or 20 feet away. And I look back and all my friends are looking at me. They're like, uh-oh, what's going on? And so I walk over there with this guy, and he stops and he looks at me and he says, son, which I should have known immediately was a problem with this, right? He said, son, I saw how closely you were standing beside that girl, and I know exactly what you were thinking, and I think you need to quit doing that. I gotta tell you, with the gift of sarcasm that God has given me, right? And at 15, without the gift of any filter that I'm still trying to develop, right? I looked right back in that guy's eyes, and I said, well, do you know what I'm thinking now? And he said, I don't appreciate your tone. And I just said, see you later. And I turned around, walked away, and I grabbed Chantel's hand. You know what I wanted to do? I wanted to walk away and just make out with her right in front of him, you know? She wasn't going to go for that. So I grabbed her hand, and I said, hey, we're leaving. And I remember we got home. I don't remember how we got home, but I remember we got home, dropped her off. I went to my house. I walked in. I was pretty upset. I was just furious is what I was. And I walked in, and my mom and dad were there. And I said, hey, I'm not going to go to that church anymore. And they said, well, why? What happened? And I told them the story. And I remember my dad said, okay, you don't have to go anymore. And you know what? I don't know that I ever would have gone back to the church ever again if it weren't for the fact that my wife's parents instituted a dating rule that we could only see each other for 6 hours a week, but church hours didn't count, okay? So every time her parents' church was open, I was there with her, okay? Now, I don't know, understand the six-hour rule. I think they didn't like me or trying to get rid of me somehow. But if that church was open, I was there. But the only reason I went to church was because of the six-hour dating rule. Because I was so icy cold towards Christianity, towards the church, towards pastors, which I am still at times because of my experience, and to God. Now, here's the thing. That pastor, he wanted the best for me, I think. I mean, I'm choosing to believe that. I think he had my best interest in mind. I think that when he saw me standing there, he realized that I probably was dating this girl. He probably had my purity in mind. He probably wanted to make sure I protected that with anything and everything I could. He wanted me to have a great marriage when I was 38 and look back on our dating season and think, you know what? We really trusted God in this season. We did what he said to do, even though we didn't want to. And I'm so glad we did. I'm sure he had all that in mind. But the way that he went about it wasn't helpful at all. In fact, it was the most unwise thing I think he could have done. Now, here's the other thing about it. He was probably right, okay? At 15, if you would have come up to me at any point and say, I know what you're thinking, 50% of the time, you probably were right, okay? I was thinking about that. I was 15. That's all we could think about, you know? But being right isn't really helpful, you know? And approaching people that way isn't really helpful. See, here's what I've come to figure out. I think as Christians, we have done more to push people away from Christianity than to draw them in. You see, confrontations kind of build walls of ice around people's hearts. Confrontations don't help us go further faster in a relationship. They just build a block of ice around people's hearts. Confrontations aren't helpful. I am right and you are wrong and you should change isn't an icebreaker. That's an ice maker. That doesn't help anybody. But as Christians, we have gotten really, really good at this, haven't we? We've gotten really good at pointing out people's problems. We've gotten really good at having conversion attempts. But conversions are ice makers. Confrontations are ice makers. Projects, agendas, those are ice makers. And as Christians, we've become really, really proficient at this. And in doing so, I think have pushed so many people away from God, so many people away from Jesus, from Christianity, and from the church. But Paul said we probably shouldn't be ice makers. Paul said that we should be really wise in the way we act towards people who don't believe what we believe. Now, here's what's great. There's so many things I love about Jesus. But as I have begun to study his life more, and as I look at the accounts of his life in the first four books of the New Testament, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, Jesus completely understood this principle. Jesus understood that if he was going to capture the heart of someone who wasn't like him and who didn't believe the way that he believed, he couldn't build a wall of ice around them. Jesus was the king of leaning in to conversation. He was the king of leaning into the tension of conversation. There are so many examples of encounters that Jesus had with people in the Bible that we could look at. But my favorite encounter when it comes to this principle is the interaction that Jesus had with a guy by the name of Zacchaeus. And Zacchaeus was a wee little man, and a wee little man was he. Okay, he was. You're going to sing that the rest of the day if you went to Bible Sunday school like me, okay? He was probably a short guy, okay? But that isn't what's cool about this interaction. So here's the thing about Zacchaeus that you may or may not know. Zacchaeus was a tax collector. Now, I don't know how you feel about the IRS. Probably could guess. And I don't know how you feel about our current tax situation. Again, I could probably guess. But it's a lot better than first century Israel. Because in first century Israel, Rome taxed people an exorbitant amount of money. And not only that, they would allow a Jewish person in every community to purchase the right to be the collector of taxes. And so the tax collector in the community had a quota of tax to meet. And they would walk around, and any person they saw, they could tax them for any reason they wanted to meet the quota. But it didn't stop there. Because Rome said, I don't care how much money you collect. You just have to meet your quota. So the tax collectors ended up being the most wealthy people in the community, but not for good reasons, because they were extortionists. They were hated in their community. As a Jewish person, they were a traitor to their community of Jewish friends. And as a tax collector, they were extortioners of money. They were wealthy, and everybody hated them. In fact, in the Bible, when it talks about tax collectors, the Jewish people had a unique category for tax collectors. I mean, they would talk about the sinners and the murderers and all the bad people. And then they would say, and even worse, there are tax collectors. They were the worst of the worst of the worst. And they were hated by everybody. So as Jesus is walking into the city of Jericho, Zacchaeus, where he is working and living, decides that he wants to just see Jesus. Now, Jesus is Jewish. And not only that, Zacchaeus knew that Jesus was a Jewish rabbi, a Jewish teacher, as he was known. And so there was no way a religious Jewish person was going to talk to Zacchaeus. I mean, a Jewish person wouldn't even talk to him. I mean, they may punch him in the face, but they're not going to talk to him, you know? And so Zacchaeus decides, I don't want to talk to Jesus. I just want to see him. So as Jesus walked into Jericho, a huge crowd formed. And that's what happened everywhere he went, because everybody wanted to be near Jesus. Everybody wanted to hear his story. Everybody loved Jesus because he loved everybody that he bumped into. And so as he walks into Jericho, huge crowds are forming of people who hate Zacchaeus but want to see Jesus. And Zacchaeus feels the same way, but he knows he can't be with the crowd. So Luke tells us that he climbs a tree, maybe because he was so short and he couldn't see over the crowd, or maybe he climbed this tree because he just didn't want to be anywhere in the crowd, because he knew that everybody hated him in that crowd. So Zacchaeus climbs up this tree. Jesus is walking by, and here's what Luke says happened. This is unbelievable. When Jesus reached the spot, he looked up and said to him, "Zacchaeus, come down immediately." And look what Jesus said. "I saw the way that you were looking at those girls, and you're in trouble." I'm just kidding. He didn't say that, okay? That's what the pastor told me, but that's not what Jesus said. Here's what Jesus actually said to Zacchaeus. "Zacchaeus, I must stay at your house today." "Zacchaeus, I must stay at your house today." Not, "Zacchaeus, I just want to kind of visit your house. I want to peek in. Hopefully nobody will see me. I want to stay at your house today. Zacchaeus, I want to have a conversation with you. I don't want to talk at you. I just want to go get some food. I want to hang out. You can invite your tax collector friends even if you want to. It's okay. I just want to kind of get to know you. I want to know how you feel. I want to know what you think. I want to know what you believe. I don't want to argue with you. I don't want to confront you. I just want to stay with you." Isn't that incredible? That is such an incredible interaction. I mean, Jesus shouldn't have even been talking to Zacchaeus. I mean, Jesus shouldn't have even looked at Zacchaeus. In fact, Luke tells us that everybody around saw Jesus look at Zacchaeus and start talking to him, and they all began to murmur and talk amongst themselves. And they said, "Well, this guy can't be a religious leader. He's talking to Zacchaeus of all people. He's the worst of the worst. Nobody talks to Zacchaeus. Why is Jesus talking to Zacchaeus?" Now, how do you think Zacchaeus responded to Jesus? Well, it's probably no surprise. Look what he says. "So he," Zacchaeus, "came down at once, and he welcomed him gladly." To which I say, I bet he did. I'm sure he welcomed him gladly. Who wouldn't welcome a person gladly who led with conversation, not a confrontation, who led with, "Can I talk with you?" instead of, "I just need to talk at you for a few minutes." You see, here's the thing. Jesus knew exactly who Zacchaeus was. He knew exactly who he was. He knew all the problems in his life. He knew how much money he had been stealing. He knew everything about Zacchaeus. But instead of saying, "Hey, Zacchaeus, you have some problems. Can I explain some things to you? You need to change your life." He didn't do that, does he? He goes, "Zacchaeus, I just want to stay with you. I just want to have a conversation with you." Now, here's the thing. I don't know if this is true, but I bet if I were to go back and be 15 again, and if that pastor had walked by me and saw me standing beside Chantel and my friends, if he would have said to me, "Hey, Gavin, can I talk to you for a second? Because here's the deal. I'd love to take you to breakfast one day this week. On me, I'll pay for your breakfast. And I just want to have a conversation with you that I think could help you long term." Now, I don't know what I would have done, but at 15, if he offered to buy me breakfast, I probably would have gone, right? All the waffles you can eat, sign me up. I don't care what you're going to talk about. I'm there, right? And if I would have gone to breakfast with him, you know, and sat down with my chocolate milk and eggs and bacon and 14 waffles, if I would have sat down and he would have said to me, "Hey, Gavin, here's the deal. Listen, I saw how closely you were standing to that girl. That makes me think that you were probably dating. And I think that's awesome, because I remember being 15, even though you can't imagine. I remember being 15 and I remember dating. I remember how exciting it is. I remember how fun that is, what it feels like to do that. That's awesome. I'm so excited that you're in that kind of relationship. Good for you. But can I also tell you something? I want you to have the best life possible. And Gavin, I want you to protect something that's going to be really, really important to you when you get married. And right now, Gavin, you're not going to totally understand this, because your mind is not controlling your body anymore, because you are one giant hormone. But trust me, everything in you is going to lean away from this truth. But I want you to protect your purity, because one day you're going to get married. And the intimacy you're going to experience in your marriage is going to be dictated on what happens before you get married. Do you have any questions? Can we talk about this more? Wow. Can you imagine what that conversation would have felt like? Can you imagine how I would have responded to that? I'll tell you what, I don't think I would have walked away icy towards him and icy towards God and icy towards Christianity and to the church. See, Jesus understood that conversation is the key to connection. Jesus understood that if we're going to connect with people's hearts, we have to lead with conversations. I mean, look at that story of Zacchaeus, good grief. He was the most hated person in the community. He was an outsider of outsiders. I mean, nobody would talk to him. No one would give him the time of day. And Jesus walks by, and Zacchaeus is fully expecting Jesus to tell him all the problems that he has, or just tell him to get the heck out of here. We don't even want to have anything to do with you. And that's not what he does. You know why? Because Jesus understood that a conversation was the way he was going to get to his heart. And Jesus understood that if he was going to draw people in, he was going to have to do that over time through conversations. See, Jesus loved everyone so much, he was willing to have a conversation with anyone, even you, even me. See, Jesus cared so much about people's hearts. He was willing to talk to them for as long as it took and about anything it took to help create a connection, because he knew that in the end, the connection was what was going to lead to his influence. Jesus was the master at pulling people in, not pushing people away. And so for us as Christians, how can we be wise in the way that we act towards people who aren't like us? How can we be a little bit more like Zacchaeus? I'll tell you, I think instead of being ice makers, we have to be ice breakers. And I think the way that we can be ice breakers is if we are willing to engage in the tension of conversations. And if we're going to engage in conversations, here's what I'm going to promise you. It's going to be messy. It's going to take time. Sometimes we're not going to feel like we're making progress. But if we're going to choose to be an icebreaker, not an ice maker, we're going to eventually make a difference in the heart of the person we're talking with. But if we're going to refuse to embrace this, if we're going to infuse to embrace this tension, we're going to be really great at making walls of ice. And we're already great at that in a lot of ways. And there is a little bit of a place for that, and we're going to talk about that next week. But Paul said the best way for us to be wise in the way we act towards outsiders is not to be an ice maker, but to lean into the tension of conversation and lean in to the people we're talking with, not at. See, here's the thing. When we watch Jesus' interactions, he constantly leveraged conversation. And the reason he leveraged conversation is because he knew that if he was going to get to anybody's heart, that was the way it was going to happen. Now, some of you know how the story of Zacchaeus ends. It's an unbelievable moment that Jesus has. And if you can picture Zacchaeus, he's in this tree. Jesus is talking to him. He's confused already because Jesus is talking to him. I mean, good grief, right? If anybody had the right to call people out, it was Jesus. I mean, he was God, right? When he walked around, people would ask him questions, and he would answer the question before they could even ask it, because he was God. He knew what they were talking about. I mean, if anybody was qualified to walk around the city and go, "Sinner, sinner, sinner, I know what you did yesterday. I know what you did last week. I know what you did at spring break. I saw how you were standing beside that girl. I know what you were thinking." Jesus could have done that. He knew exactly. But we don't ever see him doing that. We see him leaning into conversations. And look what Zacchaeus does. The story continues. "But Zacchaeus stood up when he came down from the tree, and he said to the Lord, 'Look, Lord, here and now I give half of my possessions to the poor. And if I have cheated anybody out of anything, I will pay back four times the amount.'" Isn't that unbelievable? Jesus didn't even tell him to do that. Jesus didn't say, "Hey, Zacchaeus, now I want to go stay at your house today, but first, you got to change your behavior. You got to start thinking differently. You got to start behaving differently. I need you to dress a little better too. If you could not wear the jeans with the holes, that'd be awesome, you know?" He didn't do any of that. He said, "Hey, I just want to stay with you." And Zacchaeus goes, "Hey, thank you for leaning in my direction. I want to make some things right. And look what happens next. Jesus says to him, "Today, salvation," huge word, "today, salvation has come to this house," to Zacchaeus, "because this man too is a son of Abraham," which means that he's a Jewish believer. To which everybody standing around said, "Oh." No, he didn't, but he did. Because salvation had come because of his faith. And look what Jesus says last. "For the Son of Man came to seek and to save the lost." Now, if you are here today and you are not a Christian, if you're an outsider, as Paul kind of said, here's the thing. The reason that you are an outsider, I believe, is because you have bumped into too many insiders. The reason that you are struggling with Christianity, the reason that you're stiff-arming God, the reason that you're pushing back isn't because you bumped into Jesus. It's because you bumped into people like me who confronted you and tried to convert you and saw you as a project, but we didn't see you as a person with a heart. We didn't see you the way, honestly, that God sees you. If you're an outsider, I am convinced that if you bumped into Jesus without me being in the way, you would fall in love with him. And the reason you would is because he's already in love with you. Every single person in the Bible who wasn't like Jesus, when they met Jesus, liked Jesus. Every single one of them. I am convinced that if you met him, you would love him. And I hope as a church, we create an environment that allows you to have those kind of conversations, to learn a little bit more about who God really is, to learn a little bit more about Jesus, what he really wants for you, not from you. And my belief is that if you meet the real Jesus, you're going to love him. And listen, for those of us that are Christians in the room, good grief, we have to be good at this. There is too much at stake for us to get this wrong. There is too much at stake for us to get this wrong. We as Christians have the answer to every problem anybody will ever face: sin, sorrow, and death. We have the answer to those problems, and the answer is Jesus. But if we can't embrace the tension of conversation and lean into the journey of conversation, we're probably never going to get to provide that answer. So if you're a Christian, can I just tell you, listen, your faith is meant to be deeply private, but it was never meant, deeply personal, but it was never meant to be private. Paul wants us to be wise in the way we act towards outsiders. And the number one way we're going to do that is by embracing the tension of conversation and engaging with people who maybe aren't like us and maybe who don't believe the way that we believe. But here's my promise, is that if we choose to embrace conversation instead of leaning to confrontation, I think God has the opportunity to do something dramatic in the lives of people who we bump into, just like he did with Zacchaeus. Now, I'm going to pray for you guys, but before I do, next week, you may be wondering this question already. Next week, we're going to come back, and we're going to talk about what those conversations should actually look like. But the challenge for us for the next 7 days is to avoid agendas and projects and confrontations and lean in to some conversations. And if you're not a Christian, I'm so glad you're here. You may just want to go home, forget the Jesus part. You just need to have a conversation with your spouse. It'll be the best thing you heard today. But for the rest of us, I think there's a little more at stake. So I'd love for you guys to pray with me. Heavenly Father, thank you so much for just the opportunity that we have to be wise in the way we act towards outsiders. God, thank you for your son and the opportunity that we have to have a restored relationship with you because of what he did on our behalf. Thank you for making our relationship with you not about our behavior, but only about what you have done because of your love for us. And God, for those of us that are Christians in the room, I just pray with everything in my heart that we will embrace the tension of conversation and that in every facet of our life, we will avoid being unwise in the way that we act towards the world around us, that we will be very, very wise, that we will make the most of opportunities by leading with conversations. So God, just give us the wisdom to know what to do with that, God, and give us the courage to actually do it. We love you, and we pray this in your son's name. Amen. Hey, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you guys next week for part